picked up a book from our library here entitled Aspects of Symmetry. It's Sidney Coleman's lectures from Eriche. I want to tell you a little bit about Eriche, then a little bit about Coleman, and some of it's relevant. All of it is, in my opinion, interesting. Eriche is a mountain in Sicily. There has been, over a period of many years, a scientific activity at that site. The earliest activity was a temple of Venus, and the activity was mostly in the biological sciences. It was said that the sailors who visited the temple were thrown off the edge of the cliff there if the priestesses were not satisfied with the activities of the sailors. Much later, there were physics summer schools there, and Sid Coleman, who was a professor at Harvard, gave interesting lectures for a bunch of years. Sid was the most far-seeing and cultured, not the most, but among the most far-seeing, cultured, intelligent people in physics. He said these lectures span 14 years from 1966 to 1979. You can see that it has something to do with the period I'm talking about. This was a great time to be a high-energy theorist, the period of the famous triumph of quantum field theory. And what a triumph it was, in the old sense of the word, a glorious victory parade full of wonderful things brought back from far places to make the spectator gasp with awe and laugh with joy. I hope some of that awe and joy has been captured here. I'm going to say next slightly critical things. I opened the book to chapter 4, which is about renormalization and symmetry, a review for non-specialists. This was written in 1971, and was just before Wilson's stuff was published widely, although after Wilson's work was done. There should have been good contact between Harvard, where Sid was a professor, and Cornell, where Wilson was a professor. For one thing, Wilson had grown up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he had been a postdoc, a junior fellow at Harvard. But I'm going to use this chapter 4 to describe the old-fashioned view of renormalization. By renormalization, I mean the removal of infinities for Feynman amplitudes in perturbation theory, for Lagrangian field theories with polynomial interactions. I presented a very different view of renormalization. Renormalization is the connection between different theories at different length scales. However, as late as 1971, one could support, barely, I think, one could support that old-fashioned view. The last two points I want to make have to do with the connections between different areas of science. Sid wrote in the seventh chapter of this, I think, a very interesting piece of work on the fate of the false vacuum. What that means is that field theories like statistical mechanics problems have various phases. And if you start out in a phase which is not the lowest energy configuration, this becomes unstable in field theory and is, quote, unquote, the false vacuum. There is a line of singularities, or plane of singularities, which moves across the universe, and Sid is describing that motion of singularities across the universe as the false vacuum disappears. It's a spectacular description, a wonderful act of mind and imagination. However, Sid did not recognize, or did not care to mention, that this is exactly what happens in a first-order phase transition. So every time any one of you goes to boil water to make coffee or something like that, that's what you see. This particular connection was never made. It is not entirely surprising that the particular connection was never made. Sid Coleman and another colleague, Alan Luther, had offices next to each other at Harvard. Sid was working on field theories with a continuously varying complex object in them, and Alan Luther was working on the so-called XY model, which is describable as a situation in which you have a magnetization that can point in any direction in a plane. They were, in essence, working on the same problem. They ended writing long papers on this same problem, and until someone from outside of Harvard, far from there, joined offices next to each other, told them that they had written papers on the same subject, they didn't have a clue. The unity of physics is important and worthwhile. In particular, Alan Luther's not having a clue about this was rather bad, since, in fact, at the same time at Cornell, Kostelitz and Thallus were working on the same problem, and unlike Alan, solved it correctly. Okay. So I'm going to start again from essentially where I was last time. I'm going to talk about extended singularity theorem. Here it is. I'm going to tell you again about how I feel about renormalization stuff, and then go on to tell you about what happened, a little bit about what happened after 1971. Each universality class shows a connection between a microscopic internal symmetry, that is, for the Ising model's up and down internal symmetry, or rotation in a plane for the XY model, and the topological properties of the space in which the phase exists. That is a large hunk of space. It mathematically should be infinite, but at least make the whole thing work, it should be much larger than the range of forces. This universality class shows thermodynamic singularities. These are correlation functions which fall off algebraically. It has internal parameters, for example, the coherence length, which is the particle physics's internal inverse particle mass. These things have singular behavior. For example, the coherence length goes to infinity as a power of t minus tc. And what all of this does is it gives you a connection between the internal symmetry, which is something you see in the microscopic behavior, and the macroscopic thing that occurs in the whole system. This is a connection between the macro world, the world of big things, and the micro world, the world of small-scale interactions. In contrast to Dirac, who thought that the renormalization idea was ugly because it involved infinities, my belief is that this formulation of the renormalization idea is both elegant and beautiful. That's what that says. So I disagree with Dirac. Renormalization provides what I think of as a quite elegant connection among theories. And it is important, as I was trying to tell you with the story about Alan Luther and Sidney Coleman, it's important to keep your eyes open and look beyond your own office and your own desk, because there are interesting things going on in science elsewhere. And if you don't watch out for those interesting things, you're going to tend to be left out. So Wilson brought us a revolution. The crucial ideas for the revolution were the idea that you should think about critical behavior as a subject in itself. This was the subject of the 1966 Conference of the Bureau of Standards. Scaling, that the behavior has an invariance as the length scale has changed. Universality is the expectation that critical phenomena problems can be divided into different universality classes, and that everything within a given universality class has exactly the same behavior in the critical region. Running coupling constants, that is, that there are parameters, like T minus TC, that effective values will change as you change the length scale. This is important in particle physics, because as one goes from scale to scale in particle physics, one expects coupling constants to change and do exciting things. For example, one expects the coupling constants in quantum chromodynamics to get weaker and weaker as one moves to higher energies, and thereby make a theory which is easier and easier to calculate and understand as the energies go up. There are effective fields of all sorts. It doesn't matter so much what's in the initial Lagrangian or Hamiltonian of the problem. As you renormalize the problem, new stuff comes in, old stuff changes, and there are effective fields of all sorts. The fixed points, there are singularities described when the couplings stop running, when they stop changing in terms of fixed points, and this is a very important idea. And this idea was, these ideas were brought together by Wilson in 1971 and provided a calculational method based on these ideas which everyone could use. Each item here, except maybe the final amalgamation, is a consensus product. I claim a certain amount of credit for one or another of these things. However, there are other guys who have equal rights to claim a certain amount of credit for one or another of these things. In fact, the whole field produced most of these ideas, and most of these ideas were things that were current in the field that just had to be expressed so that people would understand them properly. The extended singularity theorem is a particularly extreme example of that. Gibbs could have known about it. J. Willard Gibbs could have known about it in 1890. Cramer told people about it in 1937. However, it wasn't fully absorbed into the work of the field even as late as 1971. The outcome of the revolution was an excellent quantitative and qualitative understanding of phase transitions in all dimensions. We had information about universality classes. As I was telling you, all problems were divided into different universality classes based upon the dimension, symmetry of the order parameter, and other stuff. And the different universality classes have different critical behavior. For example, the Ising model, the single axis ferromagnet, and the liquid gas phase transition are in the same universality class. This changes one's viewpoint to some extent towards models. My many-year colleague and rival, Michael Fisher, is accredited with changing the viewpoint of physics and of other parts of science on what you need a model for. If you solve the Ising model near the critical point, you haven't just solved a simplified problem. You have the qualitative properties near the critical point of lots of other problems. The model is a way of expressing in simplified form what kinds of things can happen. And then you use the model to work out what actually does happen. And that gives you a different viewpoint towards a model. People in field theory and particle physics and other parts of physics still talk about toy models, as if the models did not catch any essence of reality, but were just something that you played with because you couldn't get your hands on the right universe. The viewpoint of people like myself who have followed Michael Fisher is that models are ways of representing qualitative properties of nature, and you're after those qualitative properties of nature. Conceptual advances from the renormalization group. First order phase transitions represent a choice among several available states or phases. You can have a magnetization pointing up or pointing down. The system will choose for you if the magnetic field is zero. This choice is made by the entire thermodynamic system. Critical phenomena, that is the behavior near the second order phase transition, are the vacillations in the decision making as the system chooses its phase. Information about what phase you're in is transferred from place to place via local values of the order parameter. So the magnetization, which points this way or this way, is a way of the system keeping track of what's going on and transferring to neighboring regions what is happening. There are indeed natural thermodynamic variables to describe the process. The system is best described using these variables. Each one of these so-called scaling variables obeys a simple scaling relation. References, tons and tons and tons of references. Okay, let's go on to the next thing. Questions, comments. So this is the bull that goes with what advances were produced in the course of the renormalization. Okay, so window. So we've got the next part here. Open it, cross one's fingers, hope one has the right thing. And then play. Where am I? Here we go. Back to where it says start here. And so what Wilson did was converted a phenomenology which had been invented by various people, most of what you mentioned, Whittem and myself, into a calculational method, a real theory. Instead of using a few fields, he conceptualized a whole host of fields. He added the concept to a fixed point. He considered repeated transformations. But I promise you I'd go on after 1971 and tell you where the renormalization revolution had taken us. The first really important thing that happened after 1971 was joint work of Ken Wilson and Michael Fisher. There's a picture. Wilson is on the top, Fisher's on the bottom here. What they did was an expansion in a variable called epsilon. Epsilon is defined to be 4 minus the dimension of the system. They looked at systems near 4 dimensions and discovered that something special, something unique, happened at 4 dimensions. The fixed point for the critical behavior of an Ising model came together with the fixed point of the trivial mean field behavior, and those two fixed points crossed one another. They came together. And that by doing an expansion in this parameter of 4 minus the dimensions, you could use the trivial mean field behavior. Trivial? Well, it's, I don't know if really trivial. I told you about what it was. It's something you can solve exactly and talk about. You could use the mean field behavior as a starting point, which gave an expansion. And that expansion gave all the critical indices, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, nu, all of those guys, in terms of an expansion in this parameter, 4 minus the dimension. The expansion converged rapidly, and you could get a good answer by using the first or the second order term in the expansion, which was relatively easy to calculate. So Lots and lots of people were doing the expansion. Lots of people were getting the answer to first or second order. And this was a very, very exciting thing to happen. In field theory, a similar calculation was used to show the renormalization of quantum chromodynamics by Te Hooft and Veltmont. These are people who are by nationality from the Netherlands. Veltmont worked at the University of Michigan for a bit after this. Te Hooft stayed in the Netherlands. Te Hooft pointed out to me that the Ornstein, of Ornstein and Zernike, remember they were the one who did the correlation length, the Ornstein of Ornstein and Zernike was his grand uncle. So there is some continuity in science. The epsilon expansion theory permits one to calculate everything people wanted to know about three-dimensional critical behavior. That behavior fully matched the experiments. Everything in critical phenomena in both condensed matter physics and much of particle physics seemed to be explained. Time to go home, work on another problem. Well, that isn't quite true. There are other things that one could do that hadn't been fully explored by the epsilon expansion. And I'm going to talk to you about some of the other things in the next few minutes. So there's something special about the two-dimensional XY model, a model in which, as I go through this gesture half a dozen times, I'm getting a little bored by it, a model in which the magnetization could point in any direction in a plane. It's described by variable theta, which describes the angle at which the magnetization is pointing, and a coupling between nearest neighbors, which is of the form of the cosine of the angle between the two nearest neighbors. What Koskulitz and Thallus did, among many other things, was they did a renormalization of this and showed how the thing worked. They did it in part by constructing an elegant description in terms of free electric charges and magnetic monopoles with electromagnetic interaction between them. This work was important for many reasons. One is that it's a qualitatively different behavior from the behavior we were expecting in phase transitions. The Isaac model, as you recall, has a line of couplings, some critical value of the couplings. Up here are strong interactions and a liquid gas phase transition, a jump between liquid and gas. And around here, there is a paramagnetic phase and nothing much happens. And there's a critical point right there. In the XY model, you once again have a coupling. The coupling is of the form K times the cosine of the angles of neighboring sites. However, you have critical behavior along this whole line for K bigger than some critical, some KC. And at KC, you have an extra special, wonderful kind of multi-critical points. So that's important. It was important to translate the model in terms of free charges and monopoles. It was important because this is the topological situation. What do I mean by a topological situation? Well, there were excitations which made essential use of the fact that that an angle returns to itself after it goes through 360 degrees. And there were excitations which called vortices, which made use of that, and which that was very important. Topological excitations are a big deal now throughout condensed matter and particle physics. And this was sort of the second place. I told you also where the first place for topological excitations was. It was in the one-dimensional Isaac model, where you got a block wall by flipping a whole collection of spins. The renormalization group point of view in the years following 1971 was quickly fully absorbed into particle physics. I don't think Sidney Coleman absorbed it very rapidly. However, I know that Steven Weinberg worked hard to understand what the renormalization point of view was about and to make use of it in his work. And it became a standard part of everybody's particle physics. In fact, the standard model of particle physics is precisely defined in terms of having running coupling constants and what the coupling constants do as a function of energy and distance. The model is extrapolated to short distances where weak electromagnetic and strong interactions are all of roughly equal strength, and they're all sort of weak. The idea of asymptotic freedom, that is that you get, asymptotic means you go to short distances. Freedom means that you have weak interactions, almost free particles. The idea of asymptotic freedom, that is the weakening of strong interactions at small distances, permitted high energy calculations. I should point out that de Hooft and Veltman showed that QCD was renormalizable by using a version of the epsilon expansion and many other clever ideas. A little later, Wilson is 1971, this is 1973, David Gross, Frank Wilczek, and David Politzer did a renormalization of the quantum chromodynamics, not only proved that it could be renormalized, but actually calculated the renormalization and showed how the interactions got weak at short distances. This was an extremely important moment in particle physics because this then permits us to calculate in an accurate fashion what we expect to see at short distances and, in fact, in many of the processes that go on in the Large Hadron Collider. A little later, Bernard Nienhuis, another Dutch physicist, extended the approach that, to some extent, the approach that Kostelitz and Thallus used to give a description of correlation functions in terms of a Coulomb gas, charges and magnetic monopoles. Oh, I should point out that the magnetic monopoles in this context had been invented by Dirac ages and ages and ages ago. Dirac was indeed a clever fellow. Nienhuis did screen Coulomb gas for many kinds of critical phenomena problems in two dimensions. He was able to solve problems in which the spin now took on not just two values, but two different values, and you ask whether the two spins on neighboring sites had the same values or opposite ones. For so-called ON models, a model in which there's a vector which can point in any dimension, in any direction, in n-dimensional space. You've seen me wave my hands around in two and three dimensions. Well, I'm not going to try to wave my hands around in four or five or six dimensions, nor in 3.5 dimensions, but all of these are accessible to the treatment that Nienhuis invented. So these models permitted generalizations in which the behavior varied continuously with Q, the number of states in the Potts model, or N, the number of vectors in the ON model. In a entirely different kind of application, Mitchell Feigenbaum used the renormalization group and scaling and universality to investigate the behavior of a period doubling and how a simple dynamical system could produce chaos. Let me spend a moment trying to explain what the problem was and what he did with it. Imagine you were looking at a sequence of x values, x0, x1, x2, x3, And the next x value, the j plus first value, was given by some simple function of the previous x value. Xj plus 1, for example, might be a quadratic function of the previous value, and you might ask how this depended on r, which might, for example, be in the interval between 0 and 4. You're thinking about x's in the interval between 0 and 1. For small values of r, now here's a plot. R goes up to 2 here, 4 here, and over about here it is 0. For values of r smaller than 2, what happens is that xj, as j gets large, approaches a fixed point, a single value. And that value depends on r, and it's plotted here. This is a very orderly behavior. At r equals 4, the other end, this is a different scale from the one I'm using. Now that I stand on top of the screen, I can see that it says 3 here. 3 is not the right thing from the point of view of the parameterization I use. It's 4. Here at r equals 4, all possible values of x come in. You start out maybe with a small value, and you go to a large value, and then this value, that value, this value, that value. And pretty soon you've covered the whole range between 0 and 1 in some chaotic fashion. So for small r, you have order. And for large r, you have chaos. And in between, well, I'll tell you what you get in between. But the problem, question is, how does one go from orderly behavior to chaotic behavior? How does chaos start out? People have start to think about chaos. For example, the weather has very chaotic patterns. Climate has chaotic patterns. Understanding what chaotic patterns mean is an interesting subject. And understanding how chaos can start is an interesting subject. Feigenbaum took a computer and started to play with this, generating x0, x1, x2, x3, looking at different values of r to see what happened. As r passed through 2, you got a not just one value of x. The single value was unstable. What happened is you got a stable situation, which is called a 2-cycle, in which you went from a small value of x to a large value, back to a small value, boom, 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 boom. You then had a motion up and back between two values of x. For slightly larger values of r, you have motion up and back for among four values of x. You start out with the smallest, you go up here, you go down there, you go up there, and you move up and back between among these four values of x. A little higher value of r, you have 8 values of x. A little higher, you have 16. And you squeeze in to some 2 to the nth. And then a first situation in which you have a range of values of x, a whole chaotic system of intervals of x which are possible. Feigenbaum used renormalization techniques in order to understand how that chaos started out. In particular, what he did was look at the region in which you got larger and larger, longer and longer cycles, and asked how the length of the cycles went to infinity, using a technique very close to the one that Wilson had developed. We're going to deal with what's called the operator product expansion quite a bit in the next lecture. But let me tell you what it is in the two different versions in which it's done. Remember, I told you that you could describe any critical problem in terms of a limited number of relevant couplings, that is, couplings which grew as you did renormalization. Limited number of relevant couplings means that there are a limited number of different local operators, like the magnetization and the energy density, only a finite number of those, different ones, which have different behavior. So what happens if you take two local operators, maybe a magnetization and an energy density, close to one another, separated by the small distance, small r, and multiply them by one another? If there are only a finite number of different fluctuating quantities representing the system, what has to happen is that this product gives a output which is, in effect, with some coefficients, the sum of all of these fluctuating operators. This then provides what's called an algebra, the result of multiplying two nearby guys in space gives you a result which is a sum of the other guys at neighboring points. I invented this in this form shown here, where you put the operator at the point halfway in between. Wilson, I think, did it differently, and I think a little before me. The modern version of using this is you use exactly the same thing, except that you put this point being r minus r over 2 instead of the halfway point. But this, anyone who slices it, this gives us an algebra which enables us to analyze the behavior near the critical point. Different people, including myself and Sasha Polyakov from the Soviet Union, said that once you had an algebra, you might want to think of what the algebra implies. Usually there are only a finite number of algebras that can have some properties like this, and you could probably enumerate them. If you enumerated them, you would be enumerating all the different critical phenomena problems, and you would thereby be telling the world what were the different universality classes. So Sasha and I, independently, thought that this could be done. Sasha made some progress in this direction. I made practically none, but this was the hope of both of us. I'm going to tell you again what happened in field theory. Field theory noticed that the Onsager solution of the two-dimensional Ising model could be converted into a free fermion theory. In Wilson and Fisher's epsilon expansion, that used the Ginzburg-Landau free energy formulation plus a path integral formulation of quantum mechanics to describe critical phenomena theory and to generate the 4 minus d expansion. In the years after 1971, Polyakov and others reformulated critical point theory as conformal field theory, which I'm going to tell you somewhat more about. And this reformulation provided an important new kind of field theory. Conformal field theory in practice means what happens at the critical point when all the masses, when all the correlation lengths are infinite. I will spend a few minutes now talking about conformal field theory and start, I think, my lecture on conformal field theory. I have one lecture on conformal field theory. And then after the break, Jamie Gomez will pick up on conformal field theory and tell you what it's really about. I'll wave my hands around rapidly. This is an invention in the first place of a Polyakov. he emphasized that there was a special form of field theory which holds at critical points, that is, places in which there is full-scale invariance. In two dimensions, this is super special, much more special than in three or four dimensions, because conformal invariance can be analyzed with the aid of complex variable theory, and you can get beautiful, rich things out. And I'll tell you about it. The spatial symmetry implied by conformal field theory is built up out of a special algebra called the Virasoro algebra. Unlike most of the other people in this story, whom I know personally, I don't know Virasoro, but the algebra is a wonderful invention. It is the algebra of local stress tensor densities and represents the properties of the complex variable theory on which the critical phenomena is based. A major advance was produced based on conformal field theory in 1984 by Dan Ferdant. I don't know Q's first name. He was a graduate student at the University of Chicago. Dan Ferdant, Steve Shanker, and Q produced this advance. They showed that unitarity, which is a quality of all standard particle field theories, limits the domain of field theories that you might get at in two dimensions and gives you a denumerable infinity of things. That is a listing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, of possible kinds of different field theories, starting out with a two-dimensional Ising model, going on to the three-state Potts model, and so forth, giving you a denumerable infinity of field theories, which included all of the standard cases that we played with over the years before. Conformal field theory is based on the idea of distortions. For example, calculating a correlation function between two points in a system which you then distort and the shape of it changes, and you then recalculate the correlation for functions in the distorted system. The correlation, the distortion, is done with the aid of a stress tensor, which is going to be the root of all that I'm going to be doing in a conformal field theory. This permits you to do many exact calculations. I spent years of my life, very pleasant years of my life, doing calculations with correlation functions, like correlation functions of a three spin variable, of two spin variables and an energy density variable, which turns out to have the form shown on the slide here in the two-dimensional Ising model. It is great fun to calculate stuff which you can calculate exactly and see it come out and then try to get qualitative properties of the theory out of these calculations. And one wonderful advance that I should be talking about beyond conformal field theory, although it is closely related to conformal field theory. In two dimensions, gravity, theory of gravitational interactions, is somewhat strange. As you know, there are gauge symmetries in gravity, and the gauge symmetries leave you with essentially the ability to produce any shape at all by gauge transformations. Theory of shapes in quantum gravity is two dimensions, is rather special and different. One can formulate quantum gravity theory as a classical theory in which one sums over all possible shapes, or which sums over all possible metrics on a given space, or indeed, there's another formulation in which one sums over all possible random matrices. In two dimensions, there are no physical degrees of freedom in quantum gravity. Everything is a gauge transformation. but so that the sum over all states could be carried out exactly. Gross and Migdal, this is the same Gross as mentioned before, David Gross, Douglas and Schenker, the same Schenker as mentioned before, and Brezin and Kazakov, two people whom I haven't mentioned, carried out the summations. This approach was a good start for critical phenomena problems in two dimensions. Bernard Duplantier carried out a calculation in which she calculated all of the fractal and strange properties of critical phenomena problems in two dimensions using quantum gravity. I won't be able to talk about that to any reasonable extent. Conformal field theory, I'm just summarizing all the things, the most exciting things that happened after Wilson. Conformal field theory took us to a point at which we could formulate a critical phenomena problem as on surfaces of various shapes. We used the stress tensor to crumple up the plane, and we would get different shapes. A recent area of progress arises from the work of Oded Schramm, picture of Schramm, who combined the complex analysis techniques of Lerner with methods of modern mathematical probability theory to gain new insight into the shapes which arise in critical phenomena. This sentence, this long sentence starting a recent, is correct. However, it doesn't really convey any information except that Schramm and Lerner worked on the problem. But this was something that happened in our time. It provided a restart for mathematical probability theory, which had fallen into bad times because they solved all their problems. And Schramm provided a whole set of different problems which probability theory could do. There's an element of tragedy in it, since a few years after he did this, he died in a mountain accident, but an element of triumph in that the work was related to problems in critical phenomena. One thing that we did not do in critical phenomena in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s is we did not discuss in any detail the shapes of critical clusters. You might have a region here with spin up and another region with spin down and a boundary, fractal, strange-looking boundary separating them at the critical point, but we never talked about the shapes of the boundary. Schramm's work gave us a way of discussing, dealing with the ensemble of boundary shapes that would occur in critical phenomena problems. This particular problem, which is plotted out here, is not one of the statistical mechanics problems I talked about. This particular problem is the shape of what is called a self-avoiding walk. You take all possible walks on the plane, throw out all of those that cross one another, and what is left are called self-avoiding walks. This is the shape of a typical self-avoiding walk on the plane. The method I described to you to get this self-avoiding walk is a mathematician's method. It is said that mathematicians, in order to find lions in the desert, would take a desert filled with lions, throw out all the sand, and what's left is lions. This is how you get self-avoiding random walks, according to mathematicians. You take the ones that cross, take them all, throw away the ones that cross one another. Similar kinds of patterns are produced, as I just told you a moment ago, describing the separation among critical clusters. This is a cluster calculated by Duplantier, and as you can see, it has an interesting looking shape. Problem we can solve now because of the work of Duplantier and of Schramm is to define the ensemble of cluster shapes for critical phenomena and then talk about their fractal properties. We've reached the end of this summary of critical phenomena. The last lecture, I'll come back and talk about conformal field theory, but this is the last slide in this lecture. Critical behavior occurs at but one point of the phase diagram of a typical system. The critical behavior is anomalous in that it is usually dominated by fluctuations rather than average values. These two facts, namely that it occurs only at one point and it's dominated by fluctuations, provide a partial explanation of why it took until the 1960s before critical behavior became a major scientific concern. Nonetheless, most of the ideas used in the eventual theoretical synthesis were generated in this early period. Around 1970, these concepts were combined with experimental and numerical results to provide a complete and beautiful theory. In the subsequent period, the revolutionary synthesis radiated outward to further inform particle physics, mathematical statistics, various dynamical theories. A question you might ask is, why is it that one should bother with one point in a phase diagram? Why is it that one should bother constructing theories which, for example, have the nature of critical phenomena theories? Well, there's a partial answer to that, and that answer is provided by mathematical economics. Mathematical economics has provided a synthesis which describes market behavior. The synthesis was defined to be beautiful and mathematical. It has in it the content of mean field theory in that it is describing the average behavior of many actors. Like mean field theory, it leaves out fluctuations and leaves out correlations over large segments of the market. The United States just lost several trillion dollars based on the incompetence and greed of its politicians, the greed of its leading bankers and industrialists, and upon the failures of mean field theory. To some extent, we might hope that theories which trade fluctuations better might help us a bit. Of course, overcoming greed and incompetence is not so easy. I thank you. Yes?
Where did those $3 trillion go? Because there must be the law of conservation of dollars, too.
It's perfectly easy to tell you. You have to understand my politics. My politics are that away, okay? But I will tell you where the money went. The money went to a change in the income distribution in the United States. The United States has far fewer people who earn middling incomes. Workers, people who work with their hands, like steel workers, can no longer afford a middle class style of living. Middle class people can no longer afford medical care, nor to send their children to school. But there are people who are very wealthy. Yeah. And they control a larger fraction of the wealth in the United States.
So excuse me, you were talking about the United States budget, referring to those $3 trillion.
I'm talking about the United States economy. Mm-hmm. The economy was designed so that large corporations, for example, banks, could effectively, without oversight, steal money from people. They use techniques like mortgages and the like. You ask where the money went. Well, the money went to the people who more or less understood what they were doing in the banking system.
The money hasn't disappeared. It's just gone to other people. As a good Russian, you might want to notice that, in fact, the economic system in the East and the West have converged on one another, that there are very similar things happened in both places. This is an example, perhaps, of universality. questions or comments? I told you my politics was that away. Oh, I should mention one other thing. It's famous that Landau went to prison in the Soviet period just after the 1937 period that I talked about. Recent years have released some of the records from that period. Apparently he was not exactly a sweet innocent, although his politics is something we might be able to approve of. He claimed that Stalin was brutal, that the revolution was going in the wrong direction, and that things were going very badly in the Soviet Union. Sentiments which I happen to agree with. I live here. I don't go to prison for all those sentiments. He lived there and spent a year in prison camp for those sentiments. Questions? Comments? Next time we do one lecture, I can form a field theory.